Do you have a dark curiosity? Heart Starts Pounding, Horrors, Hauntings, and Mysteries is a weekly podcast hosted by me, Kaylin Moore. Check out Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. It's almost spring, and that means flowers, warmth, rain, and for some of us, tornadoes. Four tornadoes hit southwest Michigan on March 6th, killing four and injuring numerous others. The EF3 tornado was the earliest of its strength in Michigan's recorded history, brought on by an extreme temperature swing. Here's Luke Sloan on WWJ with Branch County Emergency Management Coordinator Tim Miner. And note that while rare, this wasn't isolated. Severe weather erupted this week from Texas to the Midwest, with tornadoes reported in Texas, Illinois, and Indiana, and significant damage in several communities. AccuWeather meteorologists say this is the most widespread episode of severe weather so far in 2026, with hundreds of reports of wind, hail, and tornadoes.
Our biggest emphasis here is there were lives lost, people hurt, and property that can be replaced that the people will have to work through. So that's our main concern is you know, taking care of those that did have injuries or lives lost. We're now in that phase now of sorting through, you know, all of the different damage levels. That'll be finalized here in the coming days on exacting numbers and all that. But my initial estimate has been pretty close, about 70 affected structures.
Is there any personal stories that really stand out to you as you talk with residents as the recovery process kind of enters now soon to be a second week?
Yeah, has it already been a week?
Hard to believe.
Try to keep dragging things here.
I know, incredibly hard to believe.
It might be. So yeah, the stories grow by the day. I guess I haven't really kept track of the bazillion times I've heard where everybody was and some heroics. All of them are amazing stories. You know, the amazing stories of survival, amazing stories of good humankind deeds that took place, you know, after the storm, or great things people have done to help. Yeah, I mean, there's all those stories, you know. I mean, we're still working through so much work to do yet here that, you know, we haven't had a chance to actually like reflect on those, but there's a lot of them. Lots of good things going on.
You know, this kind of tragic event is probably something that you and your colleagues wish would never happen in your career and wish that, you know, what didn't occur. But in terms of your level of preparedness for an event like this, even though it's a nightmare scenario that nobody wants to deal with, how do you think you were prepared for handling this, and how are you assessing your response from you and your office?
Yeah, so I would concur with your, we don't get this every day in Michigan. I haven't paid attention to what the media is reporting on how many years it's been, but one of the reporters that interviewed me was telling me how many years ago it's been since this and giving me a lot of facts behind it. We plan for things like this. We try to practice for things like this. But until you're in the thick of it and now you're trying to do it on a rainy day, playing in mud, and get another weather warning in the middle of your rescue operations, adding nuance. It's testing our decision trees. It's testing our processes. It's throwing us curveballs. We just have to go with it. We just got to get it done. We've got lots of help here. We're assisted heavily by the Michigan State Police Homeland Security Division. And they provide a lot of local support to us. Lots of good partners have stepped up to the plate to help us. We're not the only one doing this. There's a lot of people involved.
Tim, my last question. You mentioned the really pretty dire need for people to give you some space and give victims of this storm some space as they recover. You know, with that being said, for people in other parts of the state who feel compelled to help, you know, but doing so from afar, what can they do to help alleviate the situation in any way they can?
Yeah, let me tell you how anyone can help, whether they're near or far. Okay. Number one, keep these people in your thoughts, you know, whatever your mode of assistive support to people is, whether it's prayer, whether it's whatever, do that. Okay. That's number one. Number two, if you want to give something, We don't need anything that is physical in nature that you can provide us. You know, I don't need a wheelbarrow. I don't need this. I don't need that. We have all that. We have a school that is completely full of everything. We don't need any more. What you can do, you could give to the United Way of Branch County. They are looking to continue the support of these people. You could give to the Victim Services Unit that's been on the ground helping these people since day one. So you could also give to the American Red Cross if that's a nonprofit that you feel is something that you feel is appropriate. We're just saying give to a cause that's going to carry this out for people. Anything you do with me today is temporary, and we don't need anything here. We're good. We get it all because we can just ask for it. Get it all. So we're going to have to support them moving forward.
Along with wild weather in spring, usually comes higher gas prices. And this year, with war raging in Iran, drivers may be in for a surprise at the pump. Here's Phil Mateer.
She loves it hot. He loves it cool. The Pod by 8 Sleep is a smart mattress cover that fits on your bed and keeps each side at the perfect temperature all night long. By staying comfortably warm or cool, the Pod helps you sleep deeper and wake up feeling more rested. Every morning, you get daily health insights and a sleep fitness score. Get up to $350 off with code DEEPSLEEP at 8sleep.com.
Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs. Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it's no secret to any of us. Gas prices are continuing to rise, with the average price in California now $5.29 a gallon. It's a 62-cent jump in a week. And the worst may be yet to come, thanks in part to a proposed update to a state climate program. So, Phil, what are you hearing?
What I'm hearing is that we have a move afoot. It's been in works for a while that would make it more stringent in what we call our cap and trade policy in California. Cap and trade is basically an idea that says that you combat climate pollution by requiring businesses to pay for what they pollute. And then, okay, so if a refinery does a lot of polluting, then the oil company has to chip into this cap and trade. And the money goes to the state for various climate change projects. Right now, a lot of it goes into high-speed rail, of all things. But if you tighten the regulations around it and the requirements around it, that could drive up the costs. And those costs are going to be passed on to consumers at the pump. So even post Iran, no matter what the outcome, and the oil starts flowing again, California is on track. The industry says could mean a dollar more a gallon by 2030. Now, people say that the companies are overreacting. It won't be that. They're doing fear mongering. They make billions of dollars. That may be true. But the fact of the matter is, the oil companies aren't going to wind up paying this. We're going to pay it at the pump because they're just going to pass it on to us. And three big concerns. Pass their letters on to the governor saying, this is what we are really worried about. You ought to be thinking about it before you make the move.
Yeah, because Iran is one thing, but we also have refineries closing. And
yes,
importing gas domestically to California is extremely expensive. So these are all some big problems.
Yeah. You know, you are really hitting the second and the third part of this puzzle or this problem. One is the cap and trade. The second is that California has made it very difficult to open, we haven't, refineries or even keep them online. You know, we have stringent regulations. They're getting older and older. We're seeing refineries shut down, and the companies are saying, we'll just do it elsewhere. We'll refine the gas elsewhere. We don't have to refine it in California. Because as you said, then we have to bring it in. You know, gas companies can sell their product anywhere. They don't have to sell it in California, but we go through, you know, 13 billion gallons a year. So it's the market's here, and we have a special blend of gas that no other state has. So there's only so much that we can get and refine in the way that are up to our standards. So there is a concern that we are, you know, in the effort to lead the world in climate change, might be strangling ourselves in the process.
So now I want to know if state lawmakers, at least in your opinion, do you think that they're interested in revisiting this or doing anything to lower these prices and maybe give Californians some relief?
Well, first of all, state lawmakers don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. Okay, they don't really want to get into this because you have the environmentalists on one side, and then you have, you know, the drivers on the other, and it's not a great place to be in between. What you do is you hand it off to agencies like the Air Quality Board or something like that for them to make the decision. We'll see hearings in Sacramento, concerns will be raised, but no, they want to offload that. The governor privately has expressed concerns and saying, look, we can't go so fast with this. Maybe we ought to slow it down. He's looking at the future, not only the state's future, but his future as well. And he doesn't want to be the guy who already has California gas about $1.40 above the rest of the country, having it break $2 more than the rest of the country on his term.
Yeah, I was going to say there must be quite a political consequence to being that guy holding that bag, or lack thereof.
And so, Rebecca, you know the rule in politics. If it's a hot one, what you do is you just pass it on to the next person, okay? You just punch it.
Here's more on Iran and energy costs in the U.S. from WBEN Radio. I'm Susan Rose.
I'm Brian Mazurowski. The president says he's unacceptable, but Iran's assembly of experts has chosen the son of their now-dead leader to rule the country.
Mojtaba Khamenei is the 56-year-old son of Ali Khamenei. He's been sanctioned by the U.S. since 2019 for representing his father in an official capacity. In an Axios interview last week, President Trump called him a lightweight. Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Tammy Bruce told Fox late Sunday the president wants Iran to have a leader who will bring about peace.
He wants durable change that he knows when he leaves that this is for generations moving forward.
Meanwhile, President Trump told the Times of Israel that ending the Iran war will be a mutual decision between him and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Jill Nato, Fox News.
Oil prices soaring, stocks plunging. Dow futures were down more than 1,000 points overnight. They've come back since. It's nearly coming off the worst week that the markets have seen in about a year.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling on President Trump to tap into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But experts say a release would not have much impact on prices. Economists looking at the big picture say high energy costs, coupled with a weakening jobs market, could spell trouble ahead.
The average price of a gallon of gas in Buffalo today is $3.40 a gallon, according to the AAA. A week ago, it was $3.06 a gallon.
Wow. Well, the nice weather over the weekend has shown what winter left behind. That's a lot of potholes. WBEN's Brayton Wilson on how some people are dealing with the damage.
AAA's Dave Kirst says there's already been a slight uptick this year in drivers calling to file a claim after experiencing car damage due to those pesky potholes.
What we've seen is 2 out of every 10 have damage to that. So in the Western New York region, that works out to somewhere between 6,000 to 12,000 claims that are being filed on average throughout the year due to potholes.
While it does remain early in the pothole season, crews around the region have been keeping an early eye on the conditions of the roads to ensure potholes are being filled. If a driver may experience pothole damage on a roadway and feels it's because of neglect from local highway departments, Kirst says it never hurts to file a claim against the municipality. However, he notes it's very unlikely that the municipality would be on the hook for it.
In order for them to pay out, they would have had to receive written notice of that specific pothole that caused damage to the vehicle prior to the claim being filed against them, and then they not repair that within a reasonable time period. So in most cases, they haven't received that written notice ahead of time, which then when that happens, they deny the claim against them.
You can't avoid the potholes anymore. That's brutal.
And now we've been talking about this for weeks. It's no attention, except they put a sign up that says bump.
Bump.
That's an understatement.
Thank you.
And we've got Jill Schlesinger from JillOnMoney.com. We are 9 days into this war with Iran, Jill, and we're seeing the fallout. Stocks and crude, all of it very fluid right now.
Yeah, and I don't know how long this is going to last. None of us knows that, right? But while it lasts, I think that you should be prepared to just pay higher prices. I don't know how to sugarcoat that. Already, we're seeing the price of gas up by 48 cents a gallon in 1 week. That is enormous, right? And I think that that could feed through to other parts of the economy. Groceries, you know, you have to get groceries from one place to another. We also get most of our fertilizer comes from the Middle East, so that could actually impact the farmers out there. So all in all, I think it's probably wise to just count on some short term. I say short term. I don't know what that's going to mean. But, you know, I think it is going to be a short term period of time where we're going to have higher prices. And I'm sorry about that, gang. I know that it's just one of those horrible pieces of information to get on a Monday morning. Sorry.
Yeah. But it really does kind of show how the oil market can impact everything else with what we've seen on Wall Street. I mean, you think, all right, oil goes up, I'm going to be paying more at the pump, but everything should be fine. Well, I mean, what's that oil used for all around the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And I think the other piece of this is that coming into this year, the price of oil was really kind of moderate. And so we're kind of fortunate that we were looking at sort of about $60, $65 crude before this year began. And now, yeah, it's horrible to see 100. It's just a question of how long it all lasts. I think at the end of the day, for most people, that they kind of get this, that like, okay, obviously this is going to be a thing, right? But I also think that what we can take away from this is this idea that for some of the longer term things in our lives, like our investments, we don't have to do anything. Like I sort of made a joke last week where someone said to me, well, what do? I said, well, I'd fill up my car this weekend. And I was sort of halfway laughing about that, but it was kind of true. Like, you got to fill up, you got to take those actions, you got to drive less, you have to think about these things right now. But when you're an investor, you don't have to think too hard. What you can do is you can say, I'm going to stick to my game plan. I don't have to guess where the stock market's going to go next. I mean, there have been, just in the last few years, periods of time where the stock market has been terrible, and just sticking to your game plan has been a very smart strategy, because over the long term, stocks and long-term investors do just fine. And so that's what to remind yourself is, hey, I'm long-term. I don't need to do anything. Taking no action is an action in and of itself. That is a very good way to proceed right now.
All right. Now, what's the next shoe to drop, though? Could it be airfares, food prices?
I think airfares for sure, which were already kind of tough as it is. But I think that food is going to be one to watch. We get an enormous amount of fertilizer from the Middle East. I didn't know that before this conflict started, to be honest with you. And so I'm looking at that and I'm saying, well, that could contribute to some bad stuff. The other thing to think about is that, you know, in these periods of volatility, it's always good to go back to the basics. Like, hey, do I have an emergency reserve? Do I need to write a check for a tuition? Or am I buying a car? Whatever that is, like, get that money out of anything risky. But also to just be very clear, control what you can control. Is that emergency reserve fund beefed up? Are you paying down your debt? Are you actually keeping the money flowing into your retirement account? You know, one of the partial success stories of being an investor is putting that money in even when things look kind of sour. So just try to stay long-term in your focus. And when it comes to the short-term, just control what you can control. Everything else is going to be noise.
It really does seem, though, like last week, Jill, if you were following the stock market day-to-day to see what the impact would be, you'd have a hard time reading it, because some days were like, oh, this is ugly. And then the others were, oh, all right, not so bad.
Funny you should say that, because I was on our morning show on Saturday morning, and one of the anchors asked me about the stock market. And I thought, oddly enough, I thought the stock market acted pretty good last week overall, meaning that if you looked at the whole week, you're right, day to day is like, you know, you could drive yourself crazy and Friday wasn't good. But if you just looked at the week itself, stocks were down about 2% on the week. That's it. And that's incredible for a week where we have launched a war and also when oil prices went up dramatically. So I was sort of heartened by that. I don't think that, you know, it really matters what happens day to day, week to week, even month to month. I do think, gang, for those people who are like, I'm waiting for mortgage rates to go down before I refinance, don't wait too long, because what is absolutely crystal clear to me is that right now, interest rates are not going down anytime soon. The Fed is not going to move interest rates. No way. Not in this environment.
All right. And it just seems like, I think a lot of us have factored in these wild swings that we're seeing.
Yeah.
But you just need to kind of just chill out and take a deep breath.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't do you any good. You know, one of the things that my mother always says to me, she goes, don't tell me not to panic, because she hates when I say that. Right. But what I'm really saying is don't take any action. You're going to feel anxiety. I get it. We all feel anxiety when stuff's happening in the world and in the markets and in our face when it comes to our spending. So that would be gas prices, food prices. But what you can take away from this is there's only so much I can control. You know, I was interviewing this very famous investor, and I'm like, what's your key to success? And his line is, control what you can control, manage what you can't. And I think that that's a very good mantra for us to take away. It's not in our control. So the worrying about it will not be anything that will help you, but managing the things you can manage. Hey, I'm going to keep a little extra money in my savings account. Hey, I'm going to go file those taxes because I'm due a refund. I need that money now. These are things you can do right now.
All right. All great advice, Jill. Thanks so much.
So, is a billionaire tax the answer to financial woes in communities? The California Billionaire Tax Act is a 2026 ballot initiative that would impose a one-time 5% excise tax on the net worth of individuals with assets exceeding $1 billion. Here's Phil Mateer with the latest on the effort.
California's proposed billionaire tax is dividing lawmakers ahead of the midterms. It's dividing voters as well. Phil, good morning. We saw a new poll out of Berkeley that says something like 50% of voters would be for it if it made the ballot, 28% against it. I guess the question is, will it make the ballot?
Well, that's the first one. Yeah. What we have here is the idea of a 5% charge or tax on the billionaires in California, the absolute wealthiest. The idea is this one-time hit on them would make up for the cuts from the Trump administration in health care. The money would be going into the health care system of California. Now, as you said, half of the voters give it a strong thumbs up. But the question is, can it get on the ballot? And what they need is 874,000 signatures. They've got maybe between a quarter and a half of that right now, and they've got till mid-April to qualify it. But I'm going to tell you something. This billionaire's tax also shows how expensive and a business-like manner that California politics has become. You know, you go out there with signature gatherers to get these things qualified. And it used to be people would be out there with ironing boards and you'd sign various propositions and saying, yeah, I support the idea of at least putting it in front of voters. But it got professional, and it used to be they charged, maybe, you know, these people would charge the backers like 75 cents a signature. They got more and more organized. They've turned into outfits that go from state to state. They house the signature gatherers and when they're in a collecting drive. And that price per signature is now reached $12 to $15 per signature, Steve. $12 to $15. What? Yes, I'm not kidding. And it's driven up partly because the more initiatives that are headed for the ballot, the more and more these people charge. And whether it's a local measure or a state measure, for example, some of the billionaires that are opposed to this tax, they're out there gathering signatures for countermeasures. And so they're willing to pay top dollar, and top dollar keeps getting higher and higher. It's ridiculous, but that's what we're doing. The unions put $3.5 million into it so far. We'll see if they can make it work.
So the days of just volunteers walking down the street, knocking on the door and saying, hey, what do you think of this? Will you sign my petition? Sounds like those are long gone.
Well, sometimes they get volunteers out there. This drive is going to try to put them out there to get it over the top. But yes, in matter of fact, in most cases, those days are long gone. And it's not just gathering signatures. If you notice the gubernatorial campaigns, you don't see a lot of somebody for governor signs out anymore. You don't see a lot of that, what they used to call grassroots efforts like they are. They've been supplemented by professionals, professional consultings that are thought to be more effective. But it's also led to what I call, you know, this democracy industrial complex, where both Republicans and Democrats, you know, not so much interested in grassroots and getting people involved. They're interested in television ads, radio ads, polling, and paid consultants and signature gatherers to run the whole operation. It has become a multi-billion dollar business.
On one end, we have the billionaires, and on the other, there are low-paid domestic workers. Let's discuss who's getting the short end of the stick.
California has 330,000 domestic workers, and a new analysis finds that one in five is a victim of wage theft. They are being illegally paid below minimum wage. Jake Barnes, research program manager of the Workplace Justice Lab at Rutgers University and the lead author of this report. Day. So who are the workers that are being ripped off and underpaid?
The workers that we're talking about in this report are domestic workers. We see domestic work as really incorporating three kind of major types of work, three types of jobs. Childcare providers take care of children within the home rather than a childcare, daycare centers. House cleaners help keep homes clean, healthy, and safe. And home care attendants provide personal or health-related care to people with disabilities or who are ill.
Your analysis shows that these workers are losing more than $4,000 a year on average. How are they being so drastically underpaid?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that has that's rooted in history. This is something that started many years ago with the exclusions of these workers, like domestic workers, from national labor and employment laws. And this kind of precedent that was sent has continued over many years, even though many governments, such as California, have made steps to increase enforcement in these areas. There's still a lot of kind of legacies, exclusionary legacies that define this work.
Could it be that, you know, many workers in this sector may be undocumented and therefore, even though they're being underpaid, they really are scared to make a stink about it?
Yeah, a big part of it is workers, many of these workers are experiencing these violations in silence. It's very difficult for many of them, given their long hours of work and other factors, to submit complaints to the proper authorities. We actually do find, however, oftentimes these types of workers are seen as unskilled labor. We find not only are the majority of California domestic workers U.S. citizens and speak English, but also nearly half have attended or graduated from college. Unfortunately, this is an issue that we find across the country. At the Workplace Justice Lab, we've done a number of studies around minimum wage theft and minimum wage violations in states and cities across the country. And we often find that domestic workers, or particularly workers employed directly by private households, are often experience these types of violations much more often than other types of workers.
And finally, in our last 30 seconds or so, what can be done to try to stop this, to improve the situation for domestic workers?
Well, there's an idea of co-enforcement that is already being implemented in California, where worker organizations, advocacy organizations that are much better able to build trust often with these types of workers who are unwilling to come forward to state or local regulatory agencies, work directly, that enforcement authorities can work directly with these organizations to help bring these types of complaints to the fore and have these types of violations addressed.
All right, Jake, thank you. We appreciate your analysis.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
You know your customers. Ralph likes his coffee black on Fridays, but Mondays he takes a little cream. Jennifer comes in every 3 years when her lease is up to get the newer and better model. And for some reason, pepperoni pizza sells like crazy on Friday nights. Who knew? At Odyssey, we have the expertise to get your media plan done right. With ads like you're hearing right now, to targeted social media campaigns, search engine optimization, and location-based advertising. Advertise with Odyssey and help us grow your business. Visit ads.odyssey.com.